Teaching meditation can be a deeply rewarding experience. Help others improve their mental and emotional well-being, reduce stress, improve focus, increase self-awareness and self-regulation, all while deepening your own practice and understanding. Join acclaimed author, Buddhist teacher, and Emmy Award-winning musician David Nichtern on Tuesday, May 28th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time for a free online discussion on teaching meditation in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nichtern on May 28th.
I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Server Member Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Server Member Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/innerAcademy.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
What really impressed me about the Chinese-Japanese poetry, which in many respects was Zen poetry, was that there was a sense of the ordinary, that there was something marvelous and transcendent in ordinary perceptions and ordinary experience.
Hey everyone, it's Raghu back with Mind Rolling, and I have a wonderful new guest. I just said, well, we're going to get to know each other by virtue of this podcast. Hozan Alan Sanaki. Alan, Hozan, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Raghu. It's good to be here with you and your invisible Zoom audience.
Well, actually, no, we're going to have this to our Ram Dass's Be Here Now Network audience.
Ah. Oh, great. Okay.
Yeah. And Hozan's the abbot of Berkeley Zen Center, and he's been engaged in Buddhism for decades. And you also run the Clear View Project, supporting humanitarian projects in Asia, which we can talk about later. And, of course, author of multiple books. And this new one is called Turning Words, Transformative Encounters with Buddhist Teachers. And I love stories that recount experiences with great teachers. So it was up my alley.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed sort of reflecting on them and drawing them out of my mind and putting them onto paper. Mm.
Some of them I'm very familiar with, and we can talk about that too. But first off, can you just tell me your story a little bit? I mean, coming up as through childhood into teenagehood, sure. And you know, what were the things that led you to believe, perhaps I am not my mind and my emotions and my senses, and there might be a way to be happy?
Well, I grew up in the suburbs of New York, and, you know, I grew up in the 50s and the 60s, and as I high school student, I started reading Chinese and Japanese poetry.
Really?
And beat poetry.
Right.
And what really impressed me about the Chinese Japanese poetry, which in many respects was Zen poetry, was that there was a sense of the ordinary. That there was something marvelous and transcendent in ordinary perceptions and ordinary experience. And I intuited some connection with that myself. I was reading that. When I went to college, I studied writing with a wonderful poet, who's a teacher, Kenneth Koch. And also, like other children of my generation, did a fair amount of psychedelic exploring. Mm-hmm. And that also was looking at the transcendent in the very ordinary. So there was And actually, the orientation that we were taught in, we were taught poetry and literature from, was very similar and parallel. And so all these things were really of a piece for me. And it was in the summer of 1968, which was actually in the aftermath of the Columbia strike, Columbia University strike, which I took part in. I lived in the president of the university's office for a week. I was beaten and arrested.
Oh.
And we were pretty fried from that whole experience. And a group of us decided we were going to go to California. And so we went to California in driveway cars. And when we got to Berkeley, we had already read Philip Capo's book, Three Pillars of Zen, which was really the first book, I think, that conveyed that Zen was not a point of view. It was something you actually had to do with your body. And so we thought, okay, let's find a place to practice Zen. And we did. I started practicing at the Berkeley Zen Center. And we would go over every week or so to San Francisco Zen Center at the time. And we did that over the course of the summer when we were in California. And went back to New York. I had the intention of continuing to practice. And I started studying Japanese and had this idea about going to Japan. And it kind of evaporated in the kind of fierceness and smoke and mirrors of the political climate of the times in the late 60s, early 70s. And so that kind of receded into the background. Until really I kind of hit a wall with political action in the late 70s, early 80s, and felt like I had run out of script for my life. And at that point, I began to wonder what to do. I was in psychotherapy And I asked my therapist, what am I doing here on the planet? And she said, that's not a psychotherapeutic question. That's a spiritual question. And I said, oh, okay. And that's when I think the seed that had been planted in the late 60s germinated. And I started looking around for a place to pick up that practice. And it happened, I was back in Berkeley. So I went to the Berkeley Zen Center. And when I walked in there, I was home.
Mm.
And everything unfolded from that.
Mm. Amazing.
And also what unfolded at that point was a perception that the world of social and political action and the world of Buddhist practice were not necessarily two completely distinct realms. There were people who I respected who were really looking at the confluence of those things, and that kind of revolved around the Buddhist Peace Fellowship. And so that was also just a really pivotal part of my development.
Mm. Yeah, and you talk about some of the people that influence you that way, but uppermost, and for many of us, of course, Thich Nhat Hanh emblemized that those meeting rivers of practice and taking whatever it is that embodied itself in you and mm-hmm. sharing it outwardly in the world in whatever way you were suited for. So, yeah, that's and it's a big part of our lineage too, which is, I think you're obviously familiar with Ram Dass and
sure.
Those of us that went and met Neem Karoli Baba back in the day. I went to Berkeley too in 68. I'm just thinking, you're talking about Berkeley in 68. Shit, I was there. I didn't see you though.
No.
yeah, that migration. Mine was from Montreal. Yeah. Some of it was just to get warm. I thought, I got to get to California. Yeah.
I mean, California was the place to be.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, really. Now, my kids who grew up in Berkeley, they went back east to go to school.
Really, yeah?
But now one of them's back here, and one of them made it at least as far west as Chicago.
Ouch. Chicago. Oh, boy. You know what I'd like to hear you, I mean, for all of us, when in that period of time and searching, using psychedelics, finding stories of the East, we were ultimately connected with a being, a teacher that would be a guiding light
mm-hmm.
to that place in each of us that we wanted to flourish. We wanted to flourish. I think that's a good word. Right. And for me, of course, initially it was Ram Dass, but then when I met Neem Karoli Baba, I understood what Ram Dass was all about. And then suddenly I was in the presence of someone who had gone beyond polarization inside themselves. There was no more me, you, or any of that.
Yeah, and that's someone I wish I had encountered, Neem Karoli Baba.
Yeah, it was quite incredible. I actually just got off of a Zoom seminar with a bunch of, about 500 people taking a course that was derived, that we put out as part of Love, Serve, Remember Foundation, a 21-day course based on Ram Dass's Be Here Now book, The Cookbook for Sacred Living. And so I was going through all of that, and my God, look what he did way back then, give people a roadmap like that. But they asked me about Neem Karoli Baba and what was it like and all of that. And, it's so great to be put in, to be queried like that and then fall into that space, you know, so magnificently, by which the indelible times are so present on a day-to-day basis. And I wanted to ask you the same with, you know, meeting your teacher, Sojourn Mel Weitzman, who I know of. I never had the fortune to meet him, but can you talk about him and how that evolved and, you know, and that relationship?
Well, it was very interesting because it happens that when I came to Berkeley, to when my practice really began in the late 80s, he was in Japan. And so I didn't encounter him. I encountered his community. And I felt very at home there. And then a month or two later, he returned. He was receiving Dharma transmission, sort of full authorization as a priest and teacher from Ohitsu Suzuki, who was Shunryu Suzuki Roshi's son. Mm. And when Sojourn came back, it's like, oh, now I understand how this all fits together. You know, there's a mandala in which he's sitting at the center, but he's not sitting at the center in as some great force field. There's just things mysteriously happen around him that hold the community together. And I observed that. And as I wrote in the book, you know, I had to go through the phase where I discovered this person was not my father. Mm. He was not my psychotherapist. He was not my friend. He was my Buddhist teacher, which was something that, you know, was a new experience. It was something else. And in a peculiar way, I've had an unusually orthodox training, in that I lived very close in, you know, virtually in daily contact with my teacher for nearly 40 years. This is very unusual in this country. And, you know, that was wonderful. Sometimes it was hard. You know, and he was, I think I read about this in a couple of places in the book. He was profoundly ordinary, but very wise. And we've put together, there's a book of his coming out by the end of this year from Counterpoint Press, his memoir, for reflections on different parts of his life, and also then a collection of his talks. And when I read those talks, I realize it's like we were in the presence of such a balanced kind of wisdom. Mm. And again, deeply ordinary from my mind, and you should excuse me, he was not what one would ordinarily think of as a, you know, some remarkably charismatic figure. But that really suits me. That again goes back to this issue of the transcendent in the ordinary. And that was what it was. When I read his talks, I see such wisdom there. And the wisdom that he had was in many ways a direct transmission from his teacher, from Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, whom I never met, and must have been a very strong teacher. I mean, I know he was, because his words still resonate with us, but you know, people did not have a lot of time with him. You know, Sojourn was around him from about 65 until Suzuki Roshi died in 71.
Mm.
So Sōjin Roshi is really the touchstone for all of this.
Can you relate something of your exchange with him to give a
yes
taste of that relationship?
Yeah. When I began to practice, and I was about 35 when I came here the second time. And, you know, I fell into the practice really directly and pretty intensively. And I discovered that I was very taken with and interested in the various liturgical forms and Zendo forms that we had. And I wanted to do everything perfectly. And not only did I want to do things perfectly, I wanted everybody around me to do things perfectly. You know, and I think that there was a sense of anxiety that I had about trying to hold this spinning world together, which meant that everything had to be in its right place. Mm. He watched me for about a year and didn't say anything. And then one day in Doksan, which is a private interview between teacher and student, he just out of the blue said, "You should let things fall apart."
Hmm.
And that was just a riveting message. And also it was a koan or a conundrum, if you will, that stays with me. Yes. First of all, I had to accept, and there's another teacher, let me just recount something else that he, one day, and this was considerably later, you know, he was saying, everything is going so well around here, and we should remember it could just go like that in a moment. And, you know, it was a few years later, the pandemic happened. That's exactly what happened, right? You know, all of the forms, all the structures of practice that we had in that moment disappeared, and we had to start from scratch. So the conundrum is that things will fall apart. And you and I know this as we get older, right? And they will fall apart. And yet, and so you can't resist that. But at the same time, what is the mind that is stable? That is stable through the change and the transitions. And, you know, we have to determine this for ourselves.
Mm. Yeah.
So whatever he said, you know, every teaching from anybody to me is a kind of medicine, or it's something that is designed not abstractly, but very particularly to bring one back into balance. And so for him to tell me, you should let things fall apart, he was what he was really good at always was, if you brought up one side, he would bring up the other. And he would remind you that there were different sides and aspects to things. to people and to actions and to things. And it's really important to keep your mind open to all of those facets of existence.
Yeah. You know, I read one part of the book where you talked about your dad.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this is sort of a little bit uncanny, actually. And he asked you, are you happy?
Right.
And you said, well, being happy is not important. I want to be of use. That's how I want to live. And this brought up for me, my father came to India in that day to meet Neem Karoli Baba. I was at odds with him. And it wasn't sort of, I got the letter. I was telling, oh, wow, you can't believe how great we're with this being and blah, blah. But I never for one second expected him to fly from Montreal to Delhi to actually go through back in the day. It's still not that easy to do. And he did it. And he ended up with Maharaji. And myself, excuse me, and Maharaji says to him, why did you come here? And he said, well, I came to see how my sons were doing. My brother was there with me. And he said, well, how are they doing? He said, well, they seem to be happy. And Maharaji said, happiness is everything. And in that moment, or what I recall of that moment, it was about not happy, we're going to go out and do stuff to make us happy. It was about true, deep contentment with what is and being in the moment. And so at the same time, of course, and this is a famous story, meaning a week later, somewhere else, we were with him. And Neem Karoli Baba, you know, asked me if I give my father medicine. I said, yeah, I know he had a cold. I gave him some aspirin. He said, no, the yogi medicine that Ram Dass gave me. I went, acid? My dad? And my father went LSD. And he said, Maharaji said, take care of your father while he's in India. And meet me in 2 weeks. And sure enough, we ended up in Benares, where people, you know, thousands of years ago to die in the burning ghats there. And I found him a hit of acid. He took it. He was a World War II fighter. I've told this story a million times, but I got to tell it to you because it's relevant with, I think, our fathers. It's very relevant. He was a fighter pilot, a bomber pilot in the war. And he had bad PTSD. I mean, so bad, he thought he wasn't afraid to die. I mean, you know, he had dreams he could not remember or recall any of them. You know, he was really close off. Anyhow, this acid was like somebody, well, in this case, Neem Karoli Baba, tossed a stick of dynamite on him, and poof, from then on, we had an incredible, we still fought at times, but it was profoundly converted and transformed relationship as a result of that.
Well, that's a really interesting story, and in the summer of 1967, I think a year before that we had started taking LSD. My father and his second wife came to New York. This is before the story that's recounted in my book, which is a couple of years later. And he noticed that I was different than I had been. And he wanted to know why. And I said, well, I would ascribe that to what we had been doing with LSD. And then I said, would you like to try some? Which is sort of mind-boggling thing, but that's how out there all of us were at that point, right? And he did.
Really?
Yes. And wow. we had a day. We had quite a marvelous day together.
You took it as well?
Yeah.
And it's just the two of you?
Just the two of us in my apartment on 119th Street. And, yeah. You know, and we walked around. But mostly what we did was we told stories of our lives. Really? And kind of like a A-B reflection of what was I doing? How did he perceive that? What was he doing? How did I perceive that? And it was a wonderful opening. And I'm sorry to say, I think it scared him.
Oh.
And.
But during the trip, he was fine and you were.
During the trip, he was really completely open.
Wow.
But I think that the experience of it, that the intimacy of that moment was never repeated, which is very sad.
Mm.
But I do think in the story that I told about where he asked me, "Are you happy?" he was onto something. He understood something fundamental that I was not ready to understand about the utility of happiness.
Mm. And, what do you mean by that?
What I mean was, if you can't touch a kind of fundamental or elemental happiness or contentment in your life, then your sense of being useful, your compulsion to be useful will never be accomplished.
Mm. Mm.
It is its own bottomless hunger.
Right. Hungry ghost.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that Buddhism plays with that dynamic tension, particularly Zen, Mahayana. If we think about the Bodhisattva vows, beings are numberless, I vow to save them. That's impossible. The sixth ancestor, and that's also in my book, said, beings are numberless. Sentient beings of my mind are numberless. I vow to save them. And that's taking care of all of your states of mind and facing your states of mind with an attitude of loving kindness and acceptance and appreciation. And at the same time, not letting them run the show.
That is so hard for people.
It's hard, but that's our practice. That's why I said it's a dynamic. It's a dynamic tension, right?
Yeah. But loving.
In order to do that, you have to have a steadiness. So, for example, there are many images of Avalokiteshvara or Kuan Yin, the Bodhisattva of compassion, and one of them is, One of them is his/her head split into 4 or 11 visages because she's seeing the cries of the world from every direction. Another image is her sitting in what's called the posture of royal ease. You know, taking in this suffering with wisdom, with an acceptance and a readiness to move and act.
The difficulty that is so widespread, people can get down with compassion and altruism. but not towards themselves.
Well, that's a problem in the West.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's interesting because the this really basic meditation approach that people learn in certainly in Theravada Buddhism, but also in all kinds of Buddhism, of metta practice, metta bhavana, practice of loving kindness. And it's an ancient practice. You know, I'm sure that it predates Buddhism. But the traditional map of metta practice begins, it goes from, theoretically, it goes from the easiest kind of practice to the hardest kind of practice. And at least in that framework, the easiest kind of practice is, you know, you extend loving kindness to yourself. That's where you start. That's really hard for us in the West. You know, that's maybe the hardest. We have, you know, such self-punishing, such, you know, there's a woundedness that we carry that probably has much to do with our various histories. You know, many of cultures that are here have a background of deep wounds. And our nation has a background of deep wounds. At any rate, the self-conception, I think there's something different about self-conception in the West than in some cultures in the East.
Yeah. No, I've experienced it myself. I mean, there's that great story. I'm not quite sure I know that. Remember exactly what His Holiness said, but when he was told, you understand, we people here, we have a lot of self-hatred and questioning and so on. I mean, he was like, really? You know, it was something new to him. This is way, way back when.
Yeah, I've heard that story.
Yeah, yeah. It's an amazing thing. Yeah, I often wonder, and it's not, you know, and I used to think sometimes, well, you know, maybe a lot of this has to do with, you know, in terms of what's going on in this country and the polarization and the kind of transference that happened when this country was populated by people from Western Europe and the morals and the mores of these people were really strictly put onto the populace. And as that karma went down the line, that contributed to this kind of woundedness that you spoke of, which is so extraordinarily prevalent. Look what is going on all the way down to the youth right now, you know, taking their lives. Teenagers, you know, it's become endemic, and it's gotten a lot worse. But I don't know if that's the reality.
I don't. It's hard to say. You know, there's a text, there's a commentary in one of the early sutras where the Buddha says about the workings of karma, which are problematic to us in a lot of ways. But one thing he says is, if you try to understand the roots and sources of karma, you'll go crazy. You know, and so in our ceremonies of repentance and renewal, we talk about all my ancient twisted karma from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion. And I think the thrust of karma for me in in a Buddhist notion of karma is not where does it come from, but what are you going to do now with what spirit and with what energy? What's the next step you're going to take, which allows for the transformation of karma? Not why did this happen to me or what went on back there. You know, it's like, so for me, you know, I think I've done a lot of work in Burma and in India, working with the democracy movement of Burma, working with untouchable communities in India. And, you know, when I wonder, I do reflect, why am I drawn to this? And, you know, I realize, well, not much more than 100 years ago, my grandparents also and their parents came here fleeing violence and oppression. And so that's in my karma. And the question is not how do I wallow about in, say, the hereditary suffering of being born Jewish, but it's like, how do I move forward to benefit people?
Yeah.
With joy.
Yeah. You know what I love? Katagiri Roshi. I'm not familiar with him, but I, you know, in reading, know that he helped Suzuki Roshi build the Zen Center in San Francisco.
Yeah.
Who I was, of course, as many of us were in those days and now, very familiar with. And but I like what he said, karma is volitional action, which always has a fruit or a result. And then you say, then he was silent before beginning again. Rebirth is, and quiet. Rebirth means a little more silence. He sat there with a look of perplexity on his face. At last he said, I'm sorry. I cannot talk about this or explain it to you. The problem is, I believe and you do not.
Yeah.
Well, that is a moment and a half.
Yeah.
I believe, but you do not. Well, I think many people like us that have been on the path for a while, or even people not on the path that long, but are very committed practitioners and understand the need for, not understand the need, are pushed to follow a way that will, as you have been saying, create a balance in our lives that we have not had. And, you know, it's like anything, I think, that the idea of karma and reincarnation, I think it can be, there are solid ideas that can be explicated to some degree, certainly by a great teacher. We have a friend, Dr. Robert Svoboda. I don't know if you know who Robert is. He's a wonderful Ayurvedic doctor, as well as completely steeped in the Hindu tradition, in the Vedas and so on. And he had also a teacher in India who is an Aghori, which is, called the Left Hand of God kind of sect. They did really extraordinarily unusual, shall we say, meditating on corpses, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, really out there. And for the most part, they are in India still, but many of them are not, shall I say, substantial, whereas this being was completely substantial. And he wrote a trilogy of books about them, Robert did, around the Aghori. And one of them was called, the last one was called The Law of Karma. He got this download from this being. It was some of the best edification of that subject that I had encountered. And I've always used it in terms of, you know, if you want to, people asking about that, well, take a look here, because this will, this definitely points in what I believe is, you know, the right direction, whatever that means. But it was substantial. And you know, of course, it encompasses rebirth. Now, because of the being, because of Neem Karoli Baba and other beings that I bumped into back in that day, I feel like there is some substantial experiential thing going on here, which gives me real faith in the reality. And yet I tell people, listen, you're going to get whatever it is you need in every moment to allow you to get further and further into an understanding that's beyond rational mind. Mm-hmm. And this is grace. This is the grace of us as humans being here and being taken care of. And yeah, you know, it's whether it's fully developed or not, you know, that's a whole other thing. But I love Katagiri Roshi saying the problem is I believe and you do not.
Yeah. Well, you know, my Sojin Roshi, 2 points. One is when he was asked about rebirth, his response was often, "I don't remember."
That's great.
But I think that the perspective, and this goes to at least my interpretation of that Bodhisattva vow of the sixth ancestor, sentient beings of my mind are numberless.
Mm.
And I think the perspective often in Soto Zen is about moment-to-moment rebirth.
Mm.
That on a momentary basis, according to what we might call, you know, our emotional state, you can think of each emotional state as a being. And so you think of a Buddhist cosmology, you think of the six realms of that are kind of the map of Buddhist cosmology, the human, God, fighting demon, hungry ghosts, hell beings, and animals. And when you look at the wheel of becoming, there's one sitting right here next to my desk. Those are the six realms that are depicted, but they really are just symbolic of countless realms. And, you know, we experience a flow of emotional states in the course of a day in which we are, at least in one sense, reborn. And we can be reborn in any of those realms or countless others, very finely gradated. And each one of those that's a being that's born, we have to take care of them. We have to hold them compassionately. And if you do that, then they live their natural lifespan and they're born and they pass away. And in the next emotional state, another being is born. So that's the perspective that I've had communicated to me by many of my Zen teachers.
Mm. Yeah, that's great.
Which doesn't negate a larger arc of rebirth. But it's helpful to actually think of one's life that way.
Mm. Yeah. That's Ram Dass would talk about, we as humans can live on more than one plane of consciousness at the same time.
Yeah. You know,
that speaks that. Yeah. Yeah. That's great. I'm going to read something, Hozan. Then you can comment on it. It's something from Mahagoshananda that I read in the book that I really, really love. Life is eating and drinking through all of our senses, and life is keeping from being eaten. What eats us? Time. What is time? Time is living in the past or living in the future, feeding on the emotions. Beings who can say that they are mentally healthy for even 1 minute are rare in this world. Ouch. Eh? Oi. Most of us suffer from clinging to pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feelings, and from hunger and thirst. Most living beings have to eat and drink every day, every second through their eyes, ears, nose, tongue, skin, and nerves. We eat 24 hours a day without stopping. We crave food for the body, food for feeling, food for volitional action, and food for rebirth. We are what we eat. We are the world, and we eat the world. Time is also an eater. In traditional Cambodian stories, there is often a giant with many mouths who eats everything. This giant is time. If you eat time, you gain nirvana. You can eat time by living in the moment. When you just live in this moment, time cannot eat you. Also harks to Ram Dass's Be Here Now.
Yeah.
That's so great, though.
What a remarkable person. And there's a person who was full of joy.
Yeah.
Despite all that he had seen. You know, he's somebody who appeared to everybody to walk about an inch above the ground. I feel so fortunate to have met him.
Mm. Yeah, that's so great.
I'm going to need to, first of all, the battery is going down, and also I'm going to need to leave in a few minutes.
Well, we're just about done. I'm glad I got in that last little piece.
Yeah, me too. It just, you know, the confession is I haven't reread this book yet.
No?
It's like you bring up something that, oh, you know,
that's cool.
So glad that's in there. That's really meaningful to me.
Oh, that's great. That's great. I'm glad we did that. I also want to say we have somebody in common that is very dear to me, and I know you as well, and that's Roshi Joan Halifax.
Yeah. Yes.
And, you know, she was a very close friend of Ram Dass's and spent a lot of time with him and all that. And I even have a good friend who is part of this chaplaincy that she does, Roshi does, that you... Because I mentioned... Her name is Danielle Credick Ananda.
Oh, I don't know her.
Yeah, she's quite great. Anyhow, she's taking this and mentioned that she was, and she said, yeah, and there was this Zen teacher that came on and talked about ritual, something I never really was into, you know, and he just turned me around. And I thought, yeah, of course, if Roshi had him, I said, I'm doing a podcast with him tomorrow. Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, so she's in the new cohort. That's why I don't know. I'm just getting to know them.
Yeah, yeah.
But we had several live sessions, you know, video sessions with Ram Dass. They were just remarkable.
Mm. Oh, that's so great.
And yeah, I've been working with Roshi Joan for, I don't know, 12 years now.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Part of that program.
Yeah, that's great.
I'm grateful for that.
Yeah. And she, when we talk about, you know, the combination of doing the work for ourselves as well as the bodhicitta, and as well as, you know, this is not for selfishly for us. This is about what? For everyone.
Right, right.
And that message is, you know, it's what we embodied, hopefully, after we left India all those years ago and have spent time, you know, developing.
Well, I think you guys have, yeah.
Yeah, no, very fortunate. So great to meet you.
You Hozan, too. I hope we'll be, let's stay in touch.
You know, absolutely. Absolutely. And by the way, everybody, we're going to have, just go to the show notes. This is Mind Rolling, okay. Be Here Now Network. And you'll be able to link up with Hozan's book and you know, the work he does at the Zen Center in the Bay Area, Berkeley. And yeah, it's something everybody should have a little bit of an experience with, because it's quite a practice. So thank you again, Hozan. And
thank you so much, Raghu.
Yeah, and we'll catch up with you next time.
Let's do that. Yeah.
Okay.
Be well.
Bye.